Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Shamima Mayet is filling in for AB from Radio Islam Studio 212 and from Al Ansar Studio 212:45. Aslam Mayet is assisting me today.
Assalamu alaikum. We thank Mustafa Darsor for kindly giving up his slot, and also our wonderful technical team, Hussein Umar in Durban and Shueb Haji in Johannesburg.
Aslam, last week Yunus Sultan briefed us on Emil Sultan. What lessons can we take from his life?
By hard work, skill and thrift, you can rise up from a railway porter to amass a fortune. By integrity, social cohesion and philanthropy, you can become a legend.
You mean stand up for yourselves only? I thought it was about time we had a female icon, and a living one at that. Today, my guest is Zuleika Mayet.
The purpose of these commemorations is to educate and inspire all of us to become better human beings.
Zuleika Mayet teaches us females that you can be true to your faith, yet break through the glass ceiling.
After 12, we will continue with the days of the life of Mrs. Mayet. Only if we have time, we will deal with WhatsApp messages or questions. If you put your name, the WhatsApp number is 060-904-1056. I'll repeat, 060-904-1056.
Mrs. Mayet, your grandfather was born in Zabel, Surat district in Gujarat. Tell us about life in your ancestral village. How Dada arrived here, and what did he do after arriving in Durban until he ended up in Potchefstroom, once the capital of the Boer Transvaal Republic?
My forebears were farmers. The policies of and taxes levied by the British colonialists destroyed the local economy, including textile industries and farming, resulting in many youngsters leaving the village. Dada, an orphan, and his friends had left for the promise of a new life where gold rush was in full swing. Age 16, he arrived in Durban, where he worked for a year before heading for Transvaal. He paid for his journey by working as assistant to the coach driver, looking after the horses and passengers. He made it to Charlestown, where he worked for a Muslim family for a year before repeating the second half of the journey to Johannesburg.
Your book, The History of Gujarat, traces the origins of the Muslim Gujaratis from India to South Africa. Okay, so Dada is now in Igoli to make his fortune. Then what?
The Mias and Gardis, also from Dabir, had arrived much earlier and already had thriving businesses. As is common, they provided the support structure for their kinsfolk. My Dada hawked with goods given to him on credit by the Mias and Gardis. A friend had had enough of this tough, lonely life and returned to Dabil. My Dada replaced him in Potchefstroom, hawking goods to the outlying thick farms on donkey cart. Often the Afrikaner men would be away, some fighting against the British. The wife would let my Dada sleep in the barn and give him a fowl to slaughter. The Boer were illiterate and could not count, so the wife would bring the chamber pot full of money, which was kept under their bed, and give it to the Arabir. They did not call Muslim coolies, but Arabs because of their dress. So the Arabir was to simply take whatever was due to him. Such was the trust amongst the people those days.
Was your father born in Pot?
My father, aged 5, came to South Africa with his stepmother. My father worked in the shop. He married his cousin in Dabil. My eldest sibling was born in India, and she came with my mother to Potch. My mother, Amina, was in full parda, but when she realized that she was needed in the shop, she cast it aside. Her popularity was such that soon the customers called the shop Mina Savankal, instead of Dabil House.
Mina being short for Amina.
Precisely. My father graduated to a bicycle, which allowed him to get to further outlying farms more quickly. But he came back home with blisters on his bum.
The Anglo-Boer War, the British concentration camps, and the resultant depression left the Afrikaner farmers impoverished. That must have affected the family business.
Well, goods were sold on credit and payment to be made after harvest. If harvest was bad, there was no money, and the customer had to be carried until things improved. At one stage, the family business went insolvent.
It's no longer possible these days to physically discipline a child, because we are told it leads to irreparable emotional scarring.
Being children of the community, any elder could smack a naughty child. Some fathers would tell the ustad, "The flesh is yours, the bones are mine." Often, this was taken literally.
There was an occasion when your cousin and his friend stole sweets from a Chinaman shopkeeper.
The Chinese gentleman reported to my grand uncle, who tied my cousin in a sack and lowered him down the well in the family compound until the water was right up to his neck. His wife and son screamed for mercy. My grand uncle relented only when he felt the lesson had been well and truly learned.
I suppose we take it that no pun was intended on well and truly. The best friend and mentor of your sisters and yourself was the Chinese neighbor, Penchi. She was your great friend and mentor. Your sister, Bibi, was a clever one. An English lady took her home, and Bibi also stood trial for theft at the age of 10.
We often grew close ties with our customers. Despite apartheid, on a personal level, friendships grew. One customer who would often drop in our home at the back of the dukan, on one of her visits, she saw that my mother was not coping with a brood of kids. For a month, she took Bibi to her home to play with her own daughter for the day, and brought Bibi back in the evening. We kids all helped in the dukan. An Afrikaner mother and son accused Bibi of giving short change. It was clearly a setup, assuming that because Bibi was a child, my father would concede and pay them more to avoid embarrassment. Bibi was strong-headed and adamant. My father backed Bibi, and the matter went to trial. For an hour, the prosecutor threw money at Bibi to count and give the correct change. Because of Gujarati school, we kids knew our tables. Bibi was faultless. The white boy kept looking at his mother each time a question was put to him. Bibi was found not guilty in a white court.
In the middle of Afrikanerdom.
Schooling was a challenge in the Platteland, especially for girls.
Well, Poch needed a Gujarati teacher. A strictly observant Hindu was brought in. He stayed with us, and my mother cooked his meals in separate utensils to avoid cross-contamination of his vegetarian diet. Poch's school went only to Standard 6. My brothers were sent to study matric, and one brother qualified as a doctor. No one, not even extended family, would ever take a female. Girls had to be looked after by their own parents. I finished matric by correspondence.
Your semi-autobiographical book, A Treasure Trove of Memories, tells the collective history of Indians in the Transvaal Dorpies, from arrival in SA right up till the birth of our rainbow democracy. The book is seen through your eyes, using your family in Poch as a typical Transvaal Muslim family. The guest speaker at the launch of the book, Treasure Trove of Memories, was Dr. Manto Shabalala. She was then Minister of Justice, or Deputy Minister of Justice.
Let us leave the boring stuff aside. Yours was a love marriage. Revolutionary at the time, because in your family, marriage was between cousins only. at worst, within the same gam. But your sister Bibi married a Durbanite doctor and you followed her.
My brother brought his fellow medical students home on weekends, including Mohammed Mayat. The friendship grew from there and we exchanged letters. His interest was perked further by my letters published in the Indian Views, a Durban paper widely read in South Africa and in other African countries. The editor Musa Mir was the father of Fatima Mir.
In one of your husband's letters, he advised you to use acne cream. Oh, what a romantic. I'm surprised you stuck with him. Was life in the big city of Durban any different?
Mohammed was forthright, never avoided speaking the truth. Durban was conservative, where I learned of the differences between Maimans, Surtis and so on, us and them. Here, the mother-in-law ran the household, and the daughters-in-law were bored. So I invited them and a group of friends, and we formed the Women's Cultural Group. After some time, we decided to publish a small book to raise funds. Despite the skepticism from our businessmen, we used their contacts to get 60-day credit from the publisher. We paid the publisher within 30 days. That was the first Indian delights. The rest is history.
A Hindu boy visiting from London came home. His story was that when his father died, his poverty-stricken mother had to raise 5 kids in Chatsworth. Now, using the Indian delights, his mother cooked meals on a primer stove, which food the kids then delivered. That's him and his brothers and sisters. With that income, the mother educated her kids, who are now all well off, working and living overseas. And he had come home, he said, he just had to meet and take a selfie with the woman his family owed so much to.
Book sale proceeds go to a capital fund for loan bursaries for tertiary students from all races and religions. Last year, WCG gave 1 million rand loan and zakat bursaries. Would you agree that the torching of universities has something to do with education, accommodation, food, etc., all free, with no obligation to pay anything back to society?
Certainly. Charity must not create dependency, but must empower and uplift. Our generation got no handout, yet ML Sultan, Women's Culture Group and many others plowed back to lift their communities and the other South Africans as well. That is the true essence of Islamic belief.
After qualifying, many persons have to be chased to pay back the 500 rand a month, even though they may have bought a home or gone overseas trips. Two incidents by African Christian students bears mentioning. After qualifying, one sent a pen, which, when you run it over, recites the text of the Holy Quran. Another, many years after qualifying, sent a donation to the Women's Cultural Group saying, here, help another student.
What did Marhum Maulana Yunus Patel tell you about Indian delights?
At our first meeting, he wryly said, previously the bride was given the Holy Quran, now she's given Indian delights. My rejoinder was, Maulana, is that a compliment or a criticism?
I'm going to read a few messages that have come in from Women's Cultural Group members. The first from Zarina Mullah, we do not rely on public donations, but raise money from the sales of Indian delights. Yet, we are transparent. The money we earn belongs to Allah, and we owe it to ourselves to be seen to be doing right. Second one from Sara Simji, our mentor mom installed old-fashioned values in us. Although none of us ladies get paid for the enormous amount of work we put in, at our group meetings, we either bring and share or pay for the meals. Last one from Fatima Patel. At our fundraising functions, Women's Cultural Group ladies have to bring desserts, set up, serve the guests, and clean up. Yet, each of us still has to purchase a ticket to get in. Mum believes that if you do the small things right, the big things take care of themselves. I just also want to mention that if any of the group members wants to hire their hall, they've got to pay for it. They can't get it for free. Karen.
What were your hobbies?
Tennis, swimming, riding horses, fishing, reading and writing.
Behind every successful man is a woman, but you were empowered by your husband.
My husband was unique, well ahead of his time. He gave me every encouragement to spread my wings. We went everywhere together, lectures, cinema, etc. The Orient Club was a Muslim male preserve. My husband took me there. I was the sole female. Later only, myself and two other Muslim ladies were invited when they had white guests who had come with their wives.
You just want to elaborate on other things that you might have done together as a husband and wife team?
Oh, it's such a long story. The holidays we took together, the sports we played together.
Horse riding,
fishing. Assam, if I go through that, it'll take you half an hour.
And as far as your other interests, what were your common interests? Attending lectures and plays? And
yes. And Muhammad would encourage me to do more things. If there was something I was reluctant to go to, he would push me. He says, come on, do it. So this always made me very active.
And I think you said, make mistakes, it doesn't matter. Is that correct?
That's very true. If you make your faux pas, put it behind your back and carry on.
Tell us about Women's Cultural Group.
Very early on, Women's Cultural Group, although comprised largely of Muslim ladies, had all races and religions, Hindus, Parsis, Christians, Africans and whites. Sadly, these days it is only Muslims. Over the years, WCG has done many things. Mushahiras from overseas, we sponsored Mahar Qadri. And of course, they were my mentors, Faruqi Mehta and Safi Siddiqui, under whose guidance I started to write Urdu poetry under the pen name Fahmida.
Now, when you wrote Urdu poetry, there'd be a mushaira and it would be recited there, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, would you recite it or?
No, I normally gave it to Safi Siddiqui to recite.
Okay. A reason for that?
Well, he could put it across much better.
I see. Yeah. Okay. And both of them helped in the... Because Urdu, where did you learn Urdu?
I had learned a bit of Urdu at Pottisroom, at Madrasa. But forgotten about it. When I came to Durban, and I saw people going to the Mushairas and having all those functions, now I wanted to learn. So slowly I started picking up Urdu. I went to Faruqi Mehta and three or four of us attended a class with him privately. And he took us week after week till he thought that we had learned enough.
Now, you're talking of Mushairas and things. It's not common these days. I think it's gone out. Was it popular in those
days? It was very popular those days.
And the crowds you used to get?
Basme Adab used to have something virtually every month. Crowds were full. They would come from Chatsworth. They would come from Ashwell and all over.
And I think you'd have these functions sometimes on a smaller scale at home as well.
That's right.
And you were talking of the legendary Safisa. He wrote that world-famous Allahu, which others popularized and made great, but...
Never mentioned him. WCG ladies produced and acted in two all-female Gujarati plays. Women's Culture Group had a golf day 30 years ago. Cake, Sales and Fates They call them soups these days. So popular these days. Been there, done that. There was a demonstration of Indian and Zulu culture with Prince Buthelezi as the main guest. WCD ladies visited Kwamashu to meet up with our African members, like Albertina Nguni, to look at their creche and hand over a donation. We had lots of speakers over the years. Speakers like Fatima Mir, Seth Cooper, some from overseas whom we sponsored, like architect Yaqub Zaki, controversial Yusuf Perdu, and Judge Zafrullah Khan, and Saleh Mahmood, the editor of Islamic Journal from Jeddah.
Saleh's daughter, Huma Abedin, was right-hand aide of Hillary Clinton.
You mentioned Zafrullah Khan. I think he was the UN judge in that famous case where Southwest Africa, Namibia, was given to South African mandate. And naturally, Muslims were rather unhappy about that, as were activists all over the world. Yusuf Perdu, I believe he was a closet Baha'i, is that
we
correct?
We never knew who he was till we afterwards found out.
Yeah. But I think he was knowledgeable, he was inspiring, he actually, a lot of people learnt a lot from him. Can you tell us something about
him? Expert teacher. He knew his Arabic so well, he knew the Quran so well, that we were really taken up with him. Eventually the word came around that he's a closet Baha'i. And that is then, there was such an outcry, he had to leave South Africa.
Yeah. He died somewhere in South America or something?
Somewhere there, yeah. Fashion shows.
Yeah, just before you get to that, you'll carry on with that, but as you say, there's so many things that Women's Cultural Group did. Innovators, you talked of a golf day 30 years ago, and now everybody else is following suit. The souks, you name it, you've done it. People may have perfected it. You've started these things.
The first to start fundraising dinners, first to start giving loan bursaries, first to start helping aid. Others only followed afterwards.
And you claim that's because you were women. What else did you people do?
There were fashion shows, which led to my book, Nani Ma's Chest, which was a collection of dresses and textiles of the community, lost, lying, unused in cupboards. The book intended to preserve and record these fabulous garments and to popularize it so that our younger girls took pride in wearing them. These days, the Arab black abaya is popular, and so are Western garments at weddings. And our Indian garments and shawls again, fading away.
You mentioned about these garments. I didn't even know there was a thing called pashmina until Princess Diana wore it and made it popular. And then suddenly, all the girls thought it was the next best thing since sliced bread.
I'm sorry, but Muhammad and I bought the first pashmina in India. We were looking at shawls, and an old man was serving us. Then there was a cupboard with other shawls which were closed in white cloth. So I said, why are these wrapped in white cloth? He said, these are pashminas. And he told us the history of pashminas. Since then, we were enraptured with them.
You were also enraptured with carpets and the history. And if you look at a carpet, it could tell you a whole story, and I think you learned a lot from your overseas trips. I don't think you were the person who went to sit in Jumeirah Beach, going to the shopping mall. Yours was to learn. To open your mind, and a lot of things you brought back with you, and your house is cluttered with them. If you can just tell us something about the carpets, I think that was a big part of your life.
The carpet is really a story in itself. We were told in Lahore by men that if you go and buy carpets, we had bought one or two from him, but he said if you go to Kashmir, you go and ask for this particular person and buy carpets from him. When he went there, this person not only sold carpets to us, but he showed us how it puts in the history of the people, the lifestyle of the people, how the knots have to be tied by small children. Oh, so many things about carpets that now we look at a different thing. It's not just the carpet. It's the lifeblood of a people.
What else did the Women's Cultural Group do?
We had comics like Jayalishne, Muthu Murugan, Afzal Khan, and Tesh the Bash. WCG was on tasting panels like the annual Bunny Chow contest at the Lugs. We held to raise funds for the Mali dinner to preserve the Muslim literature in Mali. Guest speaker was Feriel Hafeji, then editor of Mail and Guardian.
I think Thabo Mbeki had a big part to play in that Mali, the entire Mali project. And but unfortunately, I think some of those manuscripts got damaged thereafter. It's a real tragedy that, you know, if you want things preserved, the British Museum and the American Museum preserves it much better than we do.
You know, but those Mali things was preserved for maybe a century, and there come these Taliban types who just demolished it.
What else did you, what other dinners did you have?
Dinner to raise funds for the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation, with Leila Khalid as the main speaker. At this function, we honored the wives of our MK operatives.
Now that, you know, I find that actually quite interesting that, you know, normally we have functions and it's just to honor Palestine or whatever. And here, you know, Women's Cultural Group decided to honor our own MK operatives, and not only the operatives, the wives who stood at home, raised the family while the husbands were playing hero. Often the role of the wives in the liberation struggle is ignored, and I think that's actually a quite remarkable thing that Women's Cultural Group did.
Women's Cultural Group made written representation to the Law Commission on Muslim Personal Law and was admitted as a friend at the Constitutional Court.
Yeah, Professors White Chin and Ghulam Vahid wrote a book, and that book was commissioned by the Human Sciences Research Council, who commissioned them to do a study on and write a book about the Women's Cultures Group's remarkable, unique, fabulous history. And they then produced this book, which at that stage was a 55-year rich and varied history of the Women's Cultural Group.
You and husband Mohammed stayed a year in London.
Well, because of apartheid, Mohammed could not specialize in South Africa. So we left our three little kids with my sister-in-law. Mohammed specialized in Ghanaian obstetrics. Whilst there, I did courses in journalism and Islamic studies at the University of London.
Did you all travel much when you were in London? Did you use that opportunity to visit other places?
Even getting to London, we tried to go see something else. So we had tried to get visa for Nigeria. My husband had a zest for life and dragged me into his escapades. Nigeria had newly got independence, so we wanted to visit. Because of apartheid, South Africans could not get visas to African countries. Mohammed tried his luck at the airport whilst we were in transit. The officials would not budge. Mohammed said he was going to the toilet. After half an hour, the officials became concerned, then alarmed, then threatened to lock me up, even though I was genuinely worried at his disappearance. In the meantime, Mohammed had sneaked into an office, took out a telephone directory, and randomly phoned ministers of government. He explained to the first one he got that we blacks under the yoke of apartheid were proud of their independence and wanted to visit a free country.
A free African country.
A free African country. Eventually, Muhammad smilingly returned and told the officials to call the minister. As soon as they did, their entire demeanor changed from outright hostility to fawning servility. Was I furious when he got to a hotel room? But that was charm, but that daring charm was part of the course during our wonderful marriage, and I could never be mad for long.
Whilst you were studying, whilst he was studying a year in London, did you visit any other places?
Oh, yes. From there, we took virtually every end of the month a trip either to France or Holland and so on.
Was it by car or what?
Well, once or twice we had to go by car. We had to take the car, put it inside the plane, and we were also inside the plane. That was scary, because here you feel that here, whatever you have is here. If it goes, it's gone and you are gone.
Did you go by hovercraft?
Sorry?
Hovercraft over
No. It was a sort of private planes for passengers to sit in port, and in the bottom was the cars.
So you went to Europe and you all drove around there?
With our car.
Where? Italy, Spain? Spain. Moorish Spain must have been paradise for you.
Everything, really. But, Portugal, but, Iberia, yes.
Yeah, but the Spanish peninsula, where the Moors and so on, that rich history must have resonated with you people.
Absolutely.
You and your husband were denied passports, but allowed to attend medical conferences, which was grudgingly given to avoid international repercussions.
We repeatedly used the excuse to visit then far-flung countries like Russia and Japan. Those travels with Muhammad culminated in the book Binti Battuti.
Binti Battuti means the daughter of Ibn Battuta, that great traveler, far greater than Marco Polo, who the West only talks about. Before we get to your politics, if we can just deal with Russia. I think it was unique at that stage. Other than ANC activists, nobody even knew what Russia was about.
A lot of people had applied to go to Russia, and nobody was given a visa or aid. So Fatima Mir and Ismail said, go to London and see Dadu. He will get it for you. So we went to London. Dadu came to see us. We couldn't go to see him because he was under surveillance. And he took all the particulars, but after a week he said, I'm sorry, they don't want to give you. I said, but why? He said, well, they think that you might be spies. So in any case, our passports we had to go to Afghanistan. So when we got there, the Indian gentleman at the where he had to alter our tickets, he said, but you've got to go to Russia, and why aren't you going there? So we explained the difficulty. He said, I'll get you there. He asked us to go for a week around Afghanistan, and we could come back and pick up the air. And there it was. We got it then.
So, besides Russia, you visited Afghanistan, which must also have been a unique experience.
Unique. Afghanistan was also unique.
And when you came back, you took a lot of slides, is that right? And then people, you'd give talks here and show the slides, and there's a lot of interest, because in those days people didn't travel. But nowadays you can't travel because of coronavirus. But your political involvement was peripheral. Can you tell us something about your political involvement?
Look, in the early years, Women's Culture Group did not get involved in politics. But I did, in my personal capacity. I worked with Black Sash. Mary Grice was a member of WCG and Black Sash. Muhammad delivered the children of Prince Buthelezi. Whenever he visited us, we could not stop our Alsatian from barking at this black.
We have a message from Prince Buthelezi, who sent it specially for this show. And I quote, in those days, black people were not allowed to stay at hotels in South Africa. I remember the number of happy occasions that my wife the late Princess Irene and I stayed over at their home to enjoy the hospitality of our friends Zuleika and Mohammed. End quote.
Fatima and Ismail Mir were our close friends and my mentors. If Fatima knew you, she would drag you into her affairs. And so it was with me. The Mirs were under surveillance, and we were undercovers for them when they needed safe houses. As a result, Mandela slept overnight a few times at our home. Mohammed would pick him up and drop Nelson off in the morning at a nearby garage. When Mosi Mulla escaped from prison, our home was raided in the wee hours, but luckily, only our family was at home, and the police had to leave disappointed. At the Black Ladies Federation, with Fatima Mir and Winnie Mandela, the Women's Culture Group had arranged a dinner and served the dinner to them. Fatima Mir and I were on the Parents Committee during the UDW student boycott. The students were led by ex-constitutional judge Zach Yacoub.
Yeah, Black Women's Ladies Federation, that was like a kind of ladies' united democratic front that had been started. Yeah. I think it was something 1980s or something.
That was the first time that they got together as a group.
And Fatima Mir obviously played a huge part in that with her closest friend, Winnie. Through all Winnie's problems, Fatima stuck and stood by her. Against the wrath of Nelson.
Against my wrath too.
But look, the part that Winnie played, the difficulties she endured, bringing up the kids alone, and her charisma and what she did to liberate the country, cannot be ignored.
She's a wonderful worker, really.
There were serious errors that she made, and that should not be forgotten either. You know, this making somebody a saint or making somebody a villain, that's for newspapers and social media, but not for any real thinking person. I think the Mutalas from Maritzburg, Chota and Choti, were great friends of yours as well. Can you tell us something about that?
Through Ismail Mir, we met all the people, activists in politics, Jayan Singh, Radhi Singh, Naiker, Chota and Choti. We often had to go to their home. And at their home, at one day, the first time I heard the African National Congress, we had to hide behind a tree and sing it there because the police were always around looking after, surveilling these homes.
And Gunam used to come often home and swear like a trooper. And I think your father-in-law actually enjoyed it.
Well, even she gave out those expletives. My son was there, Naseem, and he ran out of the room. But there was father-in-law laughing.
Okay. Betty Shabazz, better known as Mrs. Malcolm X, visited your home. I'm just mentioning that. But there was a time you took food for the detainee students. Can you tell us about that?
There were 7 students detained because of the politics. It was announced in the papers that it was not permitted that anything be given to them. But I insisted going there, seeing the people there, and said, as a Muslim, I was not permitted to eat if my fellow Muslims were hungry. Because it was Ramzan, the commandant relented with the food I packed, a Quranic lights book for each.
So you pack food and you put in a Quranic lights for each of them. Yeah.
The Afrikaner commandant said literature was not allowed. And what use is this Bible? because they're all communists. They don't read. I sweetly replied, all the more reason they need to read it. This is how the students got the iftar meal and Quranic lights, a compilation of verses from the Quran with English translation. It was published before our youngsters in the Muslim community had become conscious of their deen.
Talking of prisons, you visited Robben Island and was a friend of Kathy.
Shamima, I visit Robben Island with you and Aslam to attend the world launch of the free Marwan Barghouti and all political prisoners by the Ahmed Kathrada Foundation. Now, my friendship with Ahmed Kathrada began when he wrote a letter to my brother Abdul Haq to pay condolences on the death of his friend Mohammed. My brother lived in Canada, so my mother said that I must respond to it. And that began a 10-year correspondence. When Professors Weinzen and Ghulam Wahed stumbled over it during their study of the Women's Cultural Group, they insisted that these letters be published, and they then compiled the book, Dear Zulekha Behan, Dear Ahmed Bhai. My letters were the uncensored ones I wrote, and Kathy's were the censored ones that came to me. I first met Kathy with Aslam in Victor Verster prison.
I think we'll stop there. We'll just carry on later from the Al Ansar studios. We'd like to thank Radio Islam and, of course, once again, our superb team of technical team, Hussein Umar and Shoaib Haji. And Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.